Broadcasting live from the Regis Business Center and office suites at Satellite Place in Duluth, it's time for Gwinnett Business Radio. Gwinnett Business Radio spotlights and highlights companies in Gwinnett County and the people who lead them.
And hello again, everybody, and welcome to Gwinnett Business Radio. I'm Mike Salmon, alongside my trusty co-host, Stephen Julian. Hey there, Stephen.
Hey, Mike, I will ignore the pause. Hey, I'm in a new seat today.
You're in a very comfortable seat today.
Yes, I'm closer to you. Either I'm getting promoted, or we have a very, very special guest that I want to sit across from.
Definitely not the former.
It must be the latter.
It's the latter, yes. Absolutely. And we do have a great guest joining us from the law firm of Gaslowitz Frankel LLC. It is Robert Port. Good morning, Robert. How are you?
Good morning, Mike. I'm fine. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining us today. Gaslowitz Frankel LLC, an experienced trial practice firm specializing in a lot of aspects of law. Go ahead and tell us about your firm and what do you guys specialize in?
Our focus is primarily what lawyers would call fiduciary litigation. And for the layperson, what that means is when you have an issue with someone in a position of trust who has abused that trust. So, for example, we do a lot of work in the trust and estates litigation area, and that would be a situation, for example, where if someone passes away and an executor or administrator is appointed to take care of their affairs and they don't do exactly what they're supposed to do. They mismanage the money, they mishandle the money, they don't distribute it according to the will. There are also situations in the trust arena where, for example, if a trust is set up either when someone is living or after they pass, for example, for the protection of minor children, and the trustee also does not do what they're directed to do under the trust. They misappropriate money, they don't distribute income or principal as required. So those are two principal areas. My particular focus in the practice is what I call securities litigation, and that's generally representing people who have issues with their stockbroker, financial advisor, or insurance agent. Also, people who should have a position of being a fiduciary, i.e. someone in who you repose a lot of trust and confidence to do what's right by you. And under the law, a fiduciary has the obligation, one of the highest obligations under the law, to treat somebody fairly, to do what's right for you, not for them. In other words, to put someone else's interests first. Other examples would be the relationship between partners in a business or other partnership situation. In some instances, the relationship between a corporation and its shareholders, again, in some instances. But that's generally the type of law we focus on. And we also do what lawyers would call business litigation, which is generally lawsuits, arbitrations, mediations involving business and money disputes. We don't do domestic work. We don't do criminal law. We don't do very specialized areas of the law, for example, patent or trademark or very intense tax controversies.
So typically it's if there's a disagreement as opposed to, as you say, patent law, things like that. I think I know the answer to this. Are most of your clients individuals or companies, or do you see pretty much a 50-50 split?
It's skewed more towards individuals rather than companies, but obviously companies can have disputes that we would handle on the business side. And certainly there are some instances where there are situations with a fiduciary relationship. A corporation could have a fiduciary relationship towards an individual in certain instances, so that'd be something we'd handle as well. And I think one way to think about what we do is to consider it to be dispute resolution in all different kinds of ways, through litigation, i.e. lawsuits, arbitration, mediation, attempting to reach settlement, some way to resolve disputes that people haven't been able to resolve on their own.
So jumping on that phrase of dispute resolution, I would imagine you could talk to us for hours about the broad spectrum of disputes that you've seen come across your way. My question would be, are there some generalities you can bring up of where those disputes start? Or if I'm the person who has a dispute, where should I start? What should I be thinking about? How should I start the process when I'm coming to see an attorney?
Well, there's really two questions there, and it's actually something I think about often. I think the more that I do this, one way to think about this is that lawyers are needed when people cannot resolve disputes on their own. And there's a whole range, a whole gamut of the reasons that's not the case. Sometimes it's, if you will, benign. In other words, there's simply a disagreement. Somebody has a written agreement or a verbal agreement, and there's a dispute as to exactly what that means. And then you can flow all the way to the other extreme, which is people are trying to lie, cheat, and steal. So in terms of protecting yourself, I think you need to think about specificity and accuracy and making sure that everyone is clear about what the arrangement is. If you have an agreement, don't leave anything to chance. Don't leave anything to be ambiguous, because that can lead to disputes. And we see many situations where even in a written contract, it can be viewed different ways by different people. And again, that's not something mean or sinister by the parties. It's just something that happens. And then, of course, we get into situations where people are just trying to take advantage of others. So that's one part of it. That's how to avoid getting involved. The other part of it is once you reach that point, I think it is important to consider whether you need a professional to help you resolve the dispute. Just like many of us would not work on our car ourselves or perhaps fix our air conditioning unit, lots of people try and deal with their legal issues on their own. And sometimes they're successful, but many times they only complicate matters and in fact make it more expensive, and they end up being penny wise and pound foolish, as the old saying goes.
We're talking with Robert Portes with Gaslowitz Frankel LLC, an experienced trial practice firm. Tell us a little bit about Gaslowitz Frankel. How long has the firm been around, and how large is the firm?
The firm's been around for 25 years, and in fact, Adam Gaslowitz, the senior partner, and myself go back essentially to the beginning of when we became lawyers, because we both met each other the day we took the bar exam, and we both started at the same firm, and we've remained friends ever since. We have currently five attorneys with us, and we're looking to expand. And we've developed a very good reputation in the particular areas that we practice. Adam Gaslowitz and Craig Frankel, myself, and Millie Baumbusch at our firm have all been selected as what are called super lawyers. There's a particular publication in Atlanta that surveys lawyers, and based on the legal community's responses, select certain people to be what's called a super lawyer. And in fact, Adam, I believe, was named one of the top 100 lawyers in the state with respect to that publication and his focus on trusts and estates litigation.
Robert, you talked earlier about obviously the areas that you serve, and you talked about financial investing and so forth, and you help in disputes there. And I know Stephen's ears are going to start perking up a little bit because Stephen's in the financial field. But what are some misperceptions about investing today, and maybe some of the typical mistakes that people make when they're investing today? And why do you have a big smile on your face?
Well, because he could talk for hours.
Yes, you took the words out of my mouth. I actually have a presentation I give and an article I've written whose loose title is Everything I Learned About Investing I Learned in Court. And part of that comes from my desire in doing this kind of work to try and understand and separate legitimate claims from illegitimate claims. And for me, and this is a lawyer talking, I'm not a financial advisor, I'm not a stockbroker, I'm not an insurance agent. But I think folks need to have a realistic idea of what investing is all about. You're not going to get rich. You're not going to become the next Warren Buffett. In fact, it's highly unlikely that your own advisor is going to be the next Warren Buffett. You know, what I've concluded is slow and boring, and frankly, keep your costs low, diversify heavily, and tune out a lot of the noise you hear on the media. You know, you can turn on some of the business channels, and if you watch for a half hour, you'll see people yelling to buy, people yelling to sell, do this, do that, this is going up, that's going down. you'll drive yourself crazy. And all of the academic studies show that the probability of guessing, which is what it is, guessing now as to what's going to be up or down a year from now, it's essentially a crapshoot. You know, I've seen some studies that suggest you've got about the similar odds as you would at the craps table in Vegas. So, you know, that's my view of it. And a lot of folks will disagree, and I acknowledge that. But I think what I'm saying is broadly supported by academic research. This is how a lot of pension funds invest their money, a lot of endowments, a lot of, if you will, the smart money. And I think people are misled to believe that they can turn a little into a lot. A little into a lot, when in fact what happens many times in all the running around to make money, they turn a lot into a little. You know, there's the old joke about how do you make $1 million on Wall Street? Well, you start with $5 million. So that's sort of my view of it. And I also, and again, with due respect to our insurance friends out there who are listening, I generally am not very much in favor of insurance products, as they're called. In fact, when I hear the word product associated with investments, I get a little antsy. But I'm not really in favor of insurance products that tend to mix insurance and investing. I think they are good for people who don't have the discipline to do it themselves. But if you have the discipline, you should get your insurance, pure insurance, and you should do your investing, pure investing, and proceed in that way. Because when you get into some of these products, the costs of doing so, both the cost of the product and frankly the cost of setting them up, and the insurance companies and the brokerage firms need to make a living too, they get a little piece of it along the way. And it may not seem like a lot, but over 20, 30 years of investing, you can lose literally hundreds of thousands of dollars to excess fees and costs. So that's what I would tell folks. And you know, unfortunately, I think that is a hard sell, because no one wants to hear that for your investing, you should just be average. Everybody wants to go to their cocktail party and say, well, my broker got me into this and it doubled, it tripled. You know, he got me a house on the beach. We're doing this, that, and the other thing. It is not sexy what I'm talking about. It's not, frankly, you know, something you want to talk about. But for me, my epiphany in thinking about this was the realization that we all can't be above average. You know, there's a fellow named Garrison Keillor, who is or used to have a radio show on PBS or something, who used to talk about a town where all the kids were above average. And if you think about that a moment, you know, mathematically, that's simply impossible. You know, in any large collection of people, you're going to have people who are above average. You're going to have people below average. Most of us are going to fall in the middle. And my conclusion from that with respect to investing is you sort of ignore and try and avoid each end, either the highs or the lows, and you just try and hit in the middle. And I'm convinced, and I think the academic research shows this, that if you get average returns suitable for your own particular risk profile, which is something we can talk about later, over long periods of time, you're going to do better than the vast majority of people who are running around buying this, selling this, do this, don't do that.
Any tips, and you've just given a few tips, but any very specific tips, if I'm an individual investor, and I'm thinking, what should I be thinking about, or what questions should I ask my advisor to make sure he's got my best interests at heart? What should I be looking at? What should I be willing to pay? I'm going to give you the freedom to go down any path you want to go down in terms of the investor who might be thinking, this guy sounds like he knows what he's talking about. What should I do before I go talk to a litigator?
Again, you know, being a lawyer, I'm going to give a disclaimer here, which is this is an answer as a lawyer, not as an investment advisor. But I would be on the lookout for a couple of things. I think you want someone who truly listens to you, what your needs are. If when you go to see someone, he or she, no matter what you tell them, wants to sell you this, or I've got just the investment for you, I'd politely say thanks, but no thanks. You know, investing is, I often think of an analogy to cooking and a recipe. Not everybody likes the same food, and a recipe is composed of a number of ingredients. So we may all like sugar, but we're not going to eat something that's made solely of sugar. And in a recipe, you may actually have vinegar and pepper and things that, standing alone, you wouldn't like. So you need, I think, an advisor who, A, listens to you, does a fairly thorough investigation interview of you, of your needs, your wants, get some understanding of your risk tolerance, you know, whether you want to put your kids through school or your grandkids through school, how long you're going to work, what other obligations you have, so that they can create a portfolio that's suitable for you. And suitable is, as you know, Steve, a technical word used in the investing industry that applies to brokers. Their obligation is to only recommend things that are suitable to you. So you want someone who you feel has listened to you and is not just going to sell you the same thing that they sold the person who came before you and the person who came after you. And it's particularly important, I think, to have someone who understands your risk profile, who understands whether you're going to freak out if you lose 5% of your money, or at least on paper, if it goes down 5%, or whether you're okay with that. And you understand that the markets go up and down, and in certain portfolios, you may lose, you know, 20% over the course of a year. That may be appropriate if you're 40 years old and have another 25 years to work. It may not be appropriate if you're 62 and looking to, you know, check out of the working world in a few years. So that is, I think, the most important thing to look at. You also want to look at someone who has a broad ability to provide investing options for you, whether it's securities, insurance, whatever else there may be. If you go to someone who only has one particular product, rest assured that that's what you're going to be pitched. You know, it's like the old saying, to a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And so I would recommend that folks keep all that in mind when they are looking at someone. And the final thing is not so much a legal observation, but just a general observation, which is, this is your money. If you're not comfortable with it, if your gut is telling you that something's wrong, if you don't understand it, I'd question whether it's right for you. Don't let anybody tell you, well, you know, this is really complicated, but it's great for you, don't worry about it. You know, your gut has a visceral response to things for a reason. And, you know, there's a saying, go with your gut. And I generally find that if people sort of picked up on their own emotional signals, they might be better off.
One of the, I'm gonna give a little word of recommendation based on what he just said, based on what I do for a living. I was given advice early on in my career, and it's good advice that I've always tried to follow. And that is, if it's not simple enough to explain to any investor you're sitting across from, you probably don't need to be selling it to them. Every good investment idea can be explained in very simple terms. And so that's exactly what you're saying. Any investor who doesn't understand it and asks a question and gets told, well, it's too complicated, run from that table. That's good advice.
I agree wholeheartedly. And again, not to pick on my friends in the insurance industry, and I do have friends in the insurance industry. There are many insurance products which come with a very thick disclosure document with complicated calculations about what percentage of this and that you get, and caps on returns and surrender charges. And, you know, I sort of question whether anybody understands those except the army of attorneys and actuaries who put them together somewhere deep in the bowels of the insurance company.
And if the actuaries don't understand it, then we're in real trouble.
Exactly.
Sorry, little investment joke there.
We're talking with Robert Port. He's with Gaslowitz Frankel LLC. And, you know, Robert, it seemed years ago, every time you read the paper, turned on the news, there was the latest story of a big business, of once proud business, business that has hit a lot of trouble because of the, they were cooking the books or whatever the case may be. Ponzi schemes was a big term heard all the time. Not hearing about it quite as much, but I'm assuming it's all still out there. And people need to be aware of, as you said earlier, if it sounds too good to be true, it probably is.
Absolutely. You know, although things like Madoff and there was a guy named Stanford and there were some other big Ponzi schemes, they sort of receded from the news. Ponzi schemes are always with us. I subscribe to a service which periodically gives us a list of all the Ponzi schemes, not only in the States, but apparently around the world. And it's amazing. It's absolutely amazing. And a lot of that is because people let down their guard. One of the things, and this may be a bit of a digression, but one of the things that happens in Ponzi schemes is what us lawyers call affinity fraud. And what that means is, and you could see this in the Madoff situation and other situations, is that often the Ponzi schemer, the bad guy, will work their way into, for example, a church group or the JCs or the VFW and gain the confidence of one or two people. And before you know it, everybody in that organization has this particular investment. And that's called affinity fraud because what the bad guy is doing is using the relationship he's developed with some people to sort of get into the network and pitch to others. And a lot of exactly what you said, a lot of it, and again, it's because I'm an attorney, I sometimes think I can look at this paperwork at 50 paces and see that it's not legit. And one of the things that I think people ought to consider is what might be called a benchmark. If someone is today coming to you and saying, well, I can get you 5% a month, or 20% a year, that sounds great. I'd love to have that too. But if you have some sense of what is actually going on in the economy, that your bank is paying almost nothing, that 30-year treasury bills are at what, Steve, 3%, and someone is offering you 5% a month, either it's the best investment in the world or it's a fraud, and more likely than not, it's a fraud because no one is going to get 60% a year. And what happens with Ponzi schemes, in case your listeners don't know, is that the way they work is money comes in, and then to prove that the scheme works, some of the early investors will actually get the return back. So in my 5% example, you'll have some folks who get paid 5% a year, and they'll say to all their buddies at the JCC or the church quilting club, this is great. I'm getting 5% a year, and more money comes in. And what happens with the Ponzi schemes is that the money inflow has to stay one step ahead of the money outflow. And what blew Madoff up and blows a lot of Ponzi schemes up is they reach a point where it just doesn't happen. And Madoff crashed because the market crashed. Everybody wanted their money, and he just couldn't do it. And interestingly enough, Madoff was offering a return, as I recall, about 10% a year, which is not outrageous. So it didn't look on its face like a Ponzi scheme. But there were other things that other thoughtful people noticed, which is, he did that year after year after year. And as Steve knows, you know, the market does not move in a straight line. It's up and down. It's sideways. You have great years. You have lousy years. And something that is nice and smooth either is because it's an insurance or some kind of product where you're sort of paying the insurance for that to happen, or it's just not legit. There's one other point I'd like to make about Ponzi schemes, if you have a moment,
sure.
And that is this. In many Ponzi schemes, what you see is that the scheme could not have happened without the participation of a bank or a other financial institution. And many times that participation is not intentional. They're not in cahoots with the Ponzi schemer, but they've sort of turned their back on what's going on. So, for example, in some Ponzi schemes, you'll see a bank account being used where millions of dollars are coming in and out each day. And from my perspective, as someone who does this on behalf of investors who get harmed by this, there are some significant questions to be asked as to whether the financial institution, if they paid attention to what was going on, and in these days of fighting terrorism, there's actually laws called anti-money laundering, there's a Bank Secrecy Act, there's other rules about what the banks need to do to monitor their accounts, monitor money coming in and out. And there are situations in many of these Ponzi schemes, and I believe a number of financial institutions in the Madoff matter are under scrutiny because they sort of turned a blind eye on what was going on. And, you know, billions of dollars are coming in, billions of dollars are going out, and, you know, nobody batted an eyelash. Right. So the point of that comment is many times people who have been taken will see that the bad guy or gal, women do this too, has no money, and they'll just sort of throw up their hands and say, well, I got ripped off. And maybe they'll, you know, the guy bought a Rolls Royce and they'll sell it and we'll each get, you know, 10 cents out of the money from the Rolls Royce. The point is that there may be other avenues of recovery from financial institutions that really sort of fell down on the job. So hopefully none of your listeners or anyone else gets taken by a Ponzi scheme, but my suggestion would be, if you're in that situation, don't give up and have somebody who's qualified take a look at it and see whether there's other avenues where you may get some recovery.
I think we could do an entire show just on Ponzi schemes and things like this. It's for me, it's very fascinating. Robert, you're not only a successful business litigation attorney, but I understand you're an author as well. Tell us all about your book.
Well, I guess saying I'm an author overstates it a little bit. I'm actually an editor of a book. I was approached by the Daily Report, which is a local business publication for attorneys here in Atlanta, which is owned by a parent company called ALM, American Law Media. And they are doing books in various jurisdictions, in other words, various states around the country, dealing with particular areas. So in Georgia, there is a book on divorce litigation. And these are generally written by attorneys for attorneys. There's a book on construction law. There's a book on evidence. And what I was asked to do was to edit a book on business litigation. Again, lawsuits involving generally money and property. So what I did was I gathered, I think I've got about 12 authors who are fairly well known in their field who wrote on separate topics. So I have a topic on securities litigation, on arbitration, on partnership litigation, on trade secret litigation, on something we call business torts, which is essentially fraud and misrepresentation and misappropriation and things like that. It was very interesting to do. It was a lot of work, but actually most of the credit goes to my authors because they wrote it. I gathered it together, I edited it, and got it to the editors who are actually in New Jersey, the headquarters of American Law Media, and they put it all together, and the book came out, I guess, late last year. We're working on an update now because the law is always changing and there's always new cases coming out. So every year we're going to do an update with new cases and new law and new developments.
So what's the name of the book? I want to get it to number one on Amazon. Let's go. What's the name?
The name of the book is Georgia Business Litigation. I'm sure a hot seller right after all the John Grisham and Ludlum titles.
Yeah, right after we get those, we'll go get Georgia That's Business right. Litigation. That's right. Very good. So one question also for you, Robert. So the book is a resource. Any client who sits down with you, obviously you are the main resource, and your firm is a resource. What other resources can people look for, maybe initial resources before they call and sit down, before they're on the clock, if it were, if I can use that phrase with you? I understand you guys just launched a Twitter account. I'm assuming that's a resource. So what kind of resources can people use apart from just calling you and say, Robert, I got to sit down with you as soon as possible, what other resources can people use?
Sure. I mean, we have a website, gaslewitzfrankel.com. You can also find us on Twitter at Estate Dispute. And also we have a Facebook page, and we're all just beginning to develop this. So some of this is as they always are, a work in progress. And it's facebook.com/estate dispute. I myself, in my particular area, have a number of articles I've written, mostly geared towards attorneys, but some other topical areas as well. And, you know, the website we hope to be redeveloping shortly and be a good resource for people who may have general questions in our area or just want to take a look at us and our pictures and find out a little bit about us before they give us a call.
I hope I get invited to the next workshop that you do. You titled it, I believe, going back to the beginning of the interview, Everything I Need to Know About Investing I Learned in Court. I want to be invited to that one. So
I'll be happy to do so.
So you never end up in court.
Amen.
Having to face this gentleman right here. You also have, do you have an upcoming event or events coming up, Robert, that you're involved with that are they tied in with the book?
That's right. Thank you for mentioning that. Next week, actually, I think next Tuesday evening, one of the law firms here, where one of the other authors of one of the other books, the book on evidence, as I recall, I'm sorry, the book on appeals, they're doing, a book event, I guess, if you will, sort of a book signing and a reception and things like that. And that's going to be at the Bondurant Mixon Law Firm, which is in Midtown. It's going to be interesting to see that. I know some of the authors of some of these other books, and it'll be good to see all of us together and experience what that's all about.
That's wonderful. Well, congratulations on all your success. I find it fascinating, the study and the work that you do. You mentioned it just a minute ago, your website. Go ahead and give the website, the Twitter, the Facebook one more time for those that want to find out more information about Gaslewitz Frankel, LLC.
Okay. The website is gaslewitzfrankel.com. The Twitter is @EstateDispute. And the Facebook is facebook.com/estate dispute.
All right, Robert. And for those, I'll take it one step further. For those that may not be familiar how to spell Gaslowitz Frankel, GASLOWITZ, and then Frankel, FRANKEL, gaslowitzfrankel.com. Robert, it's been a pleasure getting to meet you today. A great interview, very enjoyable, and I know for Stephen as well. And hopefully, Stephen, you'll only see him here in the studio, and you'll never see him in the courtroom.
Well, we can have lunch together, too. But yes, I hope I never face you in the courtroom. I'll just keep doing the right thing by my clients.
Robert Port from Gaslewitz Frankel, LLC. Thank you so much, Robert.
Thanks for having me.
All right. And a big thank you to all our listeners as well. A quick reminder that Gwinnett Business Radio can be heard throughout the day on the Gwinnett Business Radio X station, and that you can listen to this show or any of our shows 24/7 by logging on to GwinnettBusinessRadio.BusinessRadioX.com. For Steve and Julian,
I'm going to take a big risk, Mike, and the reason I'm going to do it at the end is so that Robert can't counter. I always heard the joke that when the investor comes up to you and says to an advisor and says, "How can I make $1 million?" The advisor says, "Give me $2 million, not five."
I've heard the same thing many a times in minor league sports field. If you want to be a successful minor league sports owner and want to make $1 million, you start with actually $10 million. So I think we've all heard the same variants of the same joke.
Absolutely.
For Robert, for Steven, for my partner and producer, Brandon, I'm Mike Salmon. We'll see you next time right here on Gwinnett Business Radio.